As a student of English at Queen's University Belfast in the 1960s, my course, naturally enough, included the poetry of W.B. Yeats. But as someone interested in theatre and acting, I found myself constantly being diverted to exploring the history of Yeats's involvement in the creation of the Abbey Theatre. Yeats had taken the radical step of disconnecting with the English literary tradition and returning to Ireland to help assert an independent literary and theatrical movement. At the centre of this movement was the Abbey Theatre, which clearly had a transformative intention and effect. It transformed the theatre and the society around it. A national theatre was created before, officially, the nation existed. Significantly, it transformed Irish writing and produced a group of Irish actors who, for the first time, became the leading players in the telling of their own story.
In my generation, and in the generation which has followed mine, one can recall many great Irish artists. Perhaps the most remarkable efflorescence of genius during these generations was in the drama. Great plays following great play. Great plays create great players. I think back over the galaxy of great players I have known, Sarah Allgood, Moira O'Neill, Arthur Sinclair, Maureen Delaney, Barry Fitzgerald. What's the use in telling over their names? You listeners know them as well as I do. But of all the players it has been my privilege to work with, I'm quite certain the greatest was F.J. McCormack.
Playwright and former artistic director Lennox Robinson asserts the greatness of the original Abbey actors, and he's not alone. They're universally acclaimed. But it's a reputation that we must take on trust. We cannot substantiate it with archive. What material survives is simply inadequate.
Give me the holy water, Nora. There's a small, soft hill on the dresser. It isn't that I haven't prayed for you vastly to the Almighty God.
Does this give us any sense of the power of Sarah Allgood? Frankly, no. Yes, when we watch F.J. McCormack in Odd Man Out, we see an actor of undoubted greatness. But does that give us a sense of what his Lear or his Joxer might have been like? And does Willie Fay's Priest in the same film give us an adequate indication of his huge contribution to Irish acting? Do the American movies in which Barry Fitzgerald appears so charmingly show us the fullness of his range and artistry? So what was it about Abbey acting with its naturalistic style and sense of ensemble that made it famous from New York to Moscow? What was it about the work of the Fay brothers with the early Abbey players that earned them universal respect? Tomás McCana joined the Abbey Company as a director in 1947, before the fire that sent the company temporarily to the Queen's Theatre. I'm just looking, Tomás, at your picture of the Abbey Theatre. Now, it only occupies a portion of the site that the current Abbey is on.
Isn't that right? It was only, you might say, a corner. Beside it, there was a big store. Uh-huh. And I'm a bit of a heretic. I was very much against having a new building. I thought they should renovate the old building because the acoustic was absolutely perfect.
No, that's why I'm saying to you that part of the notion of Abbey acting came from that building, that original building, didn't it? It was so small.
I'll tell you, when I was doing my first production, which was Jem and Grainne by Micheál MacLeomore, I was having the actors speak out, and Michael Dolan, who was a superb Abbey actor, mm-hmm. He came over and he says, young fella, keep it down, keep it down. He says, a whisper on that stage can be heard everywhere. And that was the secret. But also, when I joined the Abbey in 1947, the company was still very much influenced by the work of the Fay brothers, Willie and Frank Fay. It was they who formed the first Abbey company, mostly amateur. But they had played in small halls, their own small little theatre behind Camden Street, and then eventually the Abbey, where the acoustic was absolutely perfect. Now, Dubliners used to call the old Abbey the Shabby Theatre, and God knows it was shabby enough inside and out. It hadn't changed very much from the old mechanics. But the great thing about it was that a whisper on that stage can be heard everywhere, any place in the house. And that, I think, was the secret of the what was called, famously, the Abbey style of acting. Everything was underplayed, notably Michael Dolan himself. And nowadays, if you look back, an example of Abbey acting would be that of the late Cyril Cusack. And the company actually had been taught by the Fays to listen to each other. They moved very sparsely on the stage, did very little business, and the Fays had been inspired by the work of Coquelin, the French actor, who introduced a very natural style of acting into French theatre around the turn of the century. And they made their players, as I say, listen to what was going on, not to fuss around, and to work towards and with each other as an ensemble. I think that was the great thing about the Abbey Company in the more famous days, was that they knew each other's work. It was an ensemble. It was a permanent company. They knew each other's styles, and yet they worked together beautifully as a team. There was a tremendous teamwork from beginning to end.
Right. And then you would add to that the kind of more colloquial style of Irish people, more familiar, less formal style than the English theatre would have had.
Well, as W.G. Fay in his autobiography, The Fays of the Abbey Theatre, points out, they had the company and the playwrights came to them. Singh came along, a playwright called Cousins, later on other playwrights like Pádraig Colum and so on, and they wrote about ordinary life in Ireland. As need hardly tell you, at that particular time, in the Queen's Theatre in particular, it was mostly melodrama, sentimental melodrama, and a touch of the stage Irishness. Mm-hmm. Not exactly Boucicault. Boucicault refined it, but other playwrights as well, where everything was exaggerated. And I assume that Yeats's idea was to put an end to the idea of the stage Irishman, the rather caricature figure that appeared in these plays. And luckily enough, the playwrights at that particular time responded by coming with plays of ordinary Irish life.
In their manifesto of 1898, Yeats and Lady Gregory, along with Edward Martin, made clear their intentions for the future of Irish theatre.
We propose to have performed in Dublin, in the spring of every year, certain Celtic and Irish plays, which, whatever be their degree of excellence, will be written with a high ambition, and so to build up a Celtic and Irish school of dramatic literature. We hope to find in Ireland an uncorrupted and imaginative audience, trained to listen by its passion for oratory, and believe that our desire to bring upon the stage the deeper thoughts and emotions of Ireland will ensure for us a tolerant welcome and that freedom to experiment which is not found in theatres of England, and without which no new movement in art or literature can succeed. We will show that Ireland is not the home of buffoonery and of easy sentiment, as it has been represented, but the home of an ancient idealism. We are confident of the support of all Irish people who are weary of misrepresentation in carrying out a work that is outside all the political questions that divide us.
A of course, the Abbey Theatre didn't exist in a vacuum. Yeats and Lady Gregory's vision of an Irish theatre was part of the wider struggle for independence. When I was back in the Abbey last year, I noticed for the first time the plaque in the foyer commemorating the 7 members of the Abbey Company who had been involved in the 1916 Rising. 3 of the 7 were women, an indication of the extent of the commitment of women towards independence. The 3 were Helena Maloney, Nellie Bushell, and Myra Ní Shuailligh. Historian Sinéad McCool.
Well, Helena Maloney would have come directly to the Abbey, whereas Myra Ní Shuaillig would have come through the earlier organisation in the very, very early years. She's interesting because she came to acting through the organisation of An Éirí na hÉireann, or the Daughters of Ireland, which was established by Maud Gonne in 1900. And it was one of the activities that they did, along with their Irish dancing lessons, their Irish language lessons for children. And one of the things that they would do was bring the children, particularly from the poorer areas in Dublin, because they were trying to stop the recruitment to the British Army in particular. And what they used to tell the children were the stories of the Red Branch Knights and the Fianna, and to give them an Irish history. But it was also an Irish history that didn't have any divisions. It was heroic, it was successful deeds, it was before failed rebellions. And that's what translates really into the plays. You see the same content in the early productions that the playwrights were picking up and the poets were picking up. And I think what it was that mood that people were looking back to ancient Ireland for the references and for their sense of Irishness. So to go back that far in the past. And by virtue of the fact that the women were involved in that, so it's the idea of the educationalists, but they were also politicised, so if they weren't distributing leaflets or protesting against something, and then when it came time for them to be contributing and to be involved in acting, it was another way of putting their message forward. And so the organisation of An Éirí na hÉireann provided the first players to, as Yeats put it, he wanted to hear Irish people speaking Irish words. Now, there are certainly a lot of arguments where it was other people that came forward and the mix of things that happened. But certainly when you look at the accounts of Maud Gonne and Yeats and the sort of the correspondence between them, it certainly seems as if it's that unity that comes between Maud and Yeats. And Yeats wants to write something for Maud, and she agrees to play the character of Kathleen Ní Shuaillighean, which is very much her thinking about the spirit Ireland and the personification of Ireland as a woman, and that she would come and she would inspire younger people to go and fight for their country. So it's a wonderful beginning, and that's where it comes from. And she provides the money for that from the An Éirí na hÉireann funds, and that is one of the starting points for the Abbey.
Well, I'm certain that the energy of the Abbey acting at that time was because it was politically motivated as much as artistically motivated, you know, and that there was no artificial division between the two.
Certainly in those early years before it became the Abbey Theatre. I mean, it is documented. That's what the people wanted to do. That's what they wanted. They wanted an Irish theatre. And if you think about it, at the time, Ireland did have theatre. It had any number of touring companies coming over, but they were English players. And there was a lack of confidence in some ways that Irish people could put on plays about themselves, in the same way that, you know, in different periods in time, it's like the transformation of Irish dance or Irish film, that all of a sudden people say, oh, you know, we can do it and we can do it well. But it also can translate and it can come international. So those Irish people then were surprised when they were well received in London. Whereas in the early years when they put their plays on, their numbers were small. They were mostly Irish politicised people in the audience, whereas a lot of the normal theatre goers would not go to their plays because they were that political group. And then the plays went to England and the general audience came. And they said, OK, although it was an Irish and it was an ethnic type production, they still complimented them, even though they were amateurs rather than professional players.
Thank you. The first Abbey players may have been amateurs, but they were amateurs with a focus, a purpose, and an involvement in a redefinition of theatre. When Tomás Magana joined the Abbey in 1947, some of the early company were still working there.
May Craig, who was a great help to young players, who would give them little instruction, little advice here and there, she playing in the Words Upon the Windowpane as the medium, that's the play by Yeats. And Yeats allowed her, for the first time ever, the only time, as an actress to take a single bow on the stage after the performance. It was a superb performance. The voices of, as you know, she's a medium, and the voices of Swift coming across, and the voice of Vanessa, and the voices of Stella, all that beautifully arranged and beautifully underplayed. Eileen Crowe as Juno, the same I would say about her. I always remember the image of Eileen Crowe at the end of Juno and the Peacock, after she had gone to the Blessed Virgin's picture and said, "Where were you when my darling son was riddled with bullets? When my darling son was riddled with bullets." Then turning around and walking slowly from the stage, trailing her shawl behind her. But there were so many performers there, I remember. When one comes to the later generation, Harry Brogan, who whenever he entered, there was always a sort of a stir in the audience. And he was a superb jockster. The Ray McNally, of course, superb actor, playing the showing up of Blanco Posnet. He played Blanco Posnet. But for a moment, threw aside the underplaying and gave a marvellously passionate performance. And the Donald McCann, for instance, who was superb in the sense of Abbey playing. I'll always remember Donald McCann and Joan O'Hara, not in an Irish play, in a play by Lorca, Yerma by Lorca. But there were so many moments, and so many fine moments created by the actors over the years.
You've mentioned a lot of quite star actors, McCormack, and I'm sure Fitzgerald as well. And yet, despite the fact that they were major actors, they were somehow, there was some ethos of a company that meant that they could work happily with other people.
They knew each other's style of act. The idea of the ensemble, which was started by the Pay Brothers. You had Ria Mooney, who was a wonderfully good technician, very competent, most competent in her production of the plays. You had Lennox Robinson, well, that was before my time, but Lennox Robinson had a wonderful gift of filling in the background of each character, particularly in his own plays.
So when you came into the Abbey to direct first, there was the vestiges of the old company. There was the Eileen Crowe, there was MJ Dolan, and McCormack sadly was
There was Brian O'Higgins. Ray McNally joined about the same time as myself.
But they were the younger crowd.
They were the younger crowd.
So you had the younger crowd coming in, and they were immensely talented, I think, yeah?
Michael Dolan was very good for coming. He'd come off stage in rehearsal and perhaps see Ray McNally or perhaps see Philip O'Flynn and say, "Young fella, don't do this and don't do that." Just. And that was a little touch, a little thing. And the older players always managed to give a little hint, a little thought to a young player coming on.
Ronnie Masterson, who was married to Ray McAnally, joined the Abbey in the 40s, and she and Ray experienced the support offered by the older company members like Eileen Crowe, May Craig and MJ Dolan.
When Ray was a very young actor in there, Ray thought McDolan was God, you know. He sort of was like a father figure to him in there. And Ray went to ask him some difficulty he was having, and he said, "Listen," he said, "but I am listening." "No," he said, "listen, that's the secret of acting. Listen to what the other person is saying and the answer will come to you, you know, and it will come out in the right intonation, not something that you articulate, because this is how you get your voice down to the back of the hall.
So you were in the Abbey Company or thereabouts around in 44, 45. So that means that really you were one of the young actors who had a contact with the last of what were the original great Abbey actors.
That's true. Michael J. Dolan, May Craig, Eileen Crowe, F.J. McCormack.
So did you have much sense of them or much contact with them?
Oh, very much so. Mm-hmm. Very much so. When I went into the company, I had been playing in Gaelic plays, you know, on one-off basis. And then I played Gráinne in Dearbrother's Gráinne, and I was asked to come into the company. And at that point, no one ever said it to us, but we attended every rehearsal, whether you were in the play or not. We sat out front. We did wardrobe. We prompted. Mm-hmm. And prompting might sound like a very boring thing, but the amount you learn sitting in the wings, prompting, and hopefully not prompting, mm-hmm. but watching how these wonderful actors coped with different audiences each night. I mean, it was like being in a university.
Exactly, a huge education.
Absolutely. Mind you, we always referred to them as Miss Crowe and Miss Craig and Mr. Thing, unless they said otherwise to you. Again, it was a deference.
Yes.
To these beautiful people who were there, you know? And sitting, you know, in the green room, in the intervals, and they would be reminiscing about earlier days, and we learned a lot then as well about what it was like in the early days. When I went in first, Michael J. Dolan was the artistic director. He was later replaced by Ria Mooney, although Mick was still in the company, you know. And Ria then took all the junior players, as we was known as, in the afternoons for, well, she had two things. We did the Countess Kathleen and we did Playboy. And we would run these scenes, you know. And again, Ria was very good on verse plays. The other thing about the Abbey is this continuity thing. The wardrobe mistress had been there from the beginning. And I was asked to play in Countess Kathleen. Not Countess Kathleen, Kathleen O'Houlihan. And Ria said, go up and tell Miss Devoy that you need the band and cloak. So I come down for the dress rehearsal in a black cloak. I didn't know what a band and cloak was. It's only a kid, really. Should never have been playing the part. But anyway, she said, no, go and tell Miss Devoy you need the band and cloak. So I went up and I said, Miss Devoy, I have to have the band and cloak. Oh, Miss Allgood wore that. So she wasn't going to give it to me. So she had to give it to me. And after about three performances, the tie on the neck came out in my hand, you know, just a piece of tape. And I went up and I said, Miss Devoy, this came off. Oh, Miss Allgood wore that for years and that never came off before. So you had all of this kind of thing.
Also, it's interesting, you're talking about Ria Mooney doing the classes in the mm-hmm. in the afternoon and doing the verse. Because, of course, she was in the first productions of the O'Casey. She was the first Rosie Redmond. So she was probably deeply influenced by working in a theatre presided over by Yeats. You know, so that there was a sense of the technique of dealing with acting as well as the truth. Do you know?
Sure.
That I felt was lost by the time I joined as well.
Mm.
You know, that we were by now repeating, and repetition inevitably means a collapse, you know.
Yeah. When did you come in? Did you come in the Queen's?
Yes. It was gone.
That was the death knell of the Abbey acting. was the Queen's, because it was a bigger theatre, very small subsidy, a large company, and plays had to be whipped off if there was any sign of it not going to do the business. You couldn't afford to let it run. So there was a with the result that there's an awful lot of revivals happening in those days.
So that coarsened the acting and...
I think so. Mm. Plus the fact that it was such an uncomfortable theatre. Now, the Abbey wasn't the greatest. I mean, I'm talking about the old Abbey. Wasn't the greatest place in the world. But it was home. But I don't think the company ever felt at home in the Queen's.
You arrived at the cusp, you know. You touched the end of the great era.
I feel that I was very fortunate that I came in at a stage where all of these wonderful, what I referred to then as the old Abbey actors, were all either going to films or were dying off. And I think I'm probably one of the few people left now who was working in those days with these marvellous people and had... I mean, it was such a privilege to work with them and learn all I could learn from them. And I don't know who's... Well, there's no Abbey company now to hand it on to anybody. It's just a venue.
The Abbey became a venue and began to rely on the production of revivals and potboilers to remain open. But when the actors were offered a challenge, they invariably rose to it. Mick Hennessy as Galileo in the play by Bertolt Brecht, Pat Laid as Everyman in One for the Grave by Louis McNeice, thrilling actresses Angela Newman, Maureen O'Connell and Joan O'Hara, and in Long Day's Journey Into Night, great actors Philip O'Flynn and T.P. McKenna, who joined the company in the 50s.
1955. But I played there in 54, and in 53 I was in as an extra in the pantomime or something. I was battling at Blythe's door. He says, "Ah, your Irish is not good enough, and you have a very long nose, you know." "Your nose is just a half inch too long." But talking of Abbey's style of acting, well, if there was an Abbey style of acting, it had long disappeared by the time I came in. I'm sure you'd agree with me that I believe that the space, the theatre, makes its own demands. The old Abbey, I saw three plays in it, and they were all the cases, and it was a magical place. It really was. It was sort of something magical about the ambience, and the actors only had to whisper to be heard. Suddenly they find themselves in the Queen's Theatre, which is three times the size, holds 1,000 people, and lo and behold, everyone is shouting. Whatever the old theatre had and shaped a kind of intimate form of acting, that went out the window with the Queen's. Of course, by then, a lot of them were dead, except for Eileen Crowe and May Craig and M.J. Dolan, mm-hmm. and Harry Brogan. Philip O'Flynn had joined the Abbey very young, about 21. And the whole notion of an Abbey style of acting, as you well know, came from the fact that Lady Gregory and Yeats formed this literary society to put on Irish plays, and they had no actors. And they turned to the Fair Balzac and Willie Fay, who at that time had very, very good amateur company of actors in Dublin. And in particular, I think it was Willie Fay. He was, for his time, he was a very good teacher. And he was very shrewd, and he knew that he had amateur actors. He brought in the Allgood sisters, Sarah Allgood and Maura O'Neill, Barry Fitzgerald, other people like that. And he thought, when he got these plays of Yeats and Lady Gregory, he thought, these people don't know how to move. So what he did was he had them still and speak the lines And when they went to England, it sort of captivated the English audiences and critics, because here was a different style of acting. And that's when it, you know, took root. So I saw The Shadow of a Gunman and The Plough of the Stars in the Old Theatre. Now, the actress I saw, the one that impressed me most of all, was Mary Keane. She stood out, she was just amazing, as Maisie Madigan in those O'Casey roles. And the other one was Philip O'Flynn. I'll always remember him in Tommy Owens. He had this wonderful big-toothed smile. Tommy Owens, my name, Mr. Shields knows me well. He comes round the door. And my idea of theatre, I came from the country, and I was educated on the fit-ups, the Carrickfords, and all these travelling companies who did the old melodramas, Murder in the Red Barn. And I thought acting was a bit like, my acting would have been a bit heavy. I was attracted to this, and when I came to Dublin, when I would visit Dublin, I would always go to the gate to see Macleamore. And my thought was, oh, wonderful. And also the Gate Longford Company, because they split in two. And they were all doing Sheridan and classic plays, and that's what I loved. And then I went to see the Abbey Theatre for the first time in 1951, and my jaw dropped. I'd never seen acting like it. It was so real, as opposed to what I'd been used to. And I became a convert overnight. But after that, I kept hounding Blythe. I had this notion in my head, and it's not irrelevant, because for some reason, I thought, you must have some continuity in this, or you never learn how to act, going from Billy to Jack and so on and so on. And I hounded Blythe until one day he said, well, we'll take you on for a bit and see how you get on, you see. But you'll have to take lessons in Irish. So I promised
you. And what about your nose?
And he said, you see, we might be able to arrange it so that you're playing the love scene with you facing out front. That's an actual fact.
Would you say that, you know, the great actors who'd been in the Abbey, Philip, Cyril Cusack, would you say that they were great just because they were great, not because of anything particular that they got from the Abbey?
It's very interesting. When Cyril was a younger actor, he'd become very mannered as he got older, you know. But I saw him play the Playboy when he was in his 40s. And he was absolutely magical. He could move like a ballet dancer. He was wonderful physically. And had this delivery which he never lost from the old Abbey, of making no concessions to space in terms of projecting. I mean, I asked him once. I said, Cyril, you seem to make no concessions to the size of the theatre. He says, no, you're right, I don't. But he was, in his day, he was the man who was the big connection with that old Abbey, I think.
Cyril Cusack had first appeared on the Abbey stage as a boy in 1932 and went on to play in the first Abbey productions of O'Casey's Silver Tassie and Shaw's Candida. When I joined the Abbey company in the 60s, Cyril's daughter Sinead was also a company member.
But, you know, that indefinable quality that so many Irish actors have, and which I recognised from an incredibly early age that there was something, and I don't want to sound too chauvinistic about this, but that there was something magical about the Irish actor, particularly when you think of actors like Sarah, like Don McCann and...
Well, of course, but Cyril came, say, early 40s, where he would have had contact with McCormack, M.J. Dolan, all of those people in their prime, really.
Yeah.
Whereas Donal comes very much later at a time of collapse somehow,
indeed,
doesn't it?
Yeah,
and
that's true.
And I'm wondering how much you could say that he'd been influenced by it. I mean, I would say Donal was in complete reaction to everything about it. He was in it, but he was reacting against it, wasn't he? You know.
Yeah, but I still think in Donal's work, it was carrying on a tradition of a particular sort of acting style. Again, I hate using the word style, but you know what I mean.
No, but I mean... Don't worry about that. That's in a sense what we're trying to find here. What was it? What was the nature of Abbey acting, and what provoked it, and what sustained it, and what made it different from the acting of other countries? I mean,
I've been thinking about it a lot, and it seems to me a few of the conclusions I came to was one that our tradition is an oral, A-U-R-A-L, an oral tradition, the Shanachie, the storyteller. That's where we come from. So somehow, whereas across the water, it's a written tradition. So how it manifests in terms of the acting is that the Shanachie would have had to present an entire range of characters, an entire range of situations within the story, and he would have to tell them completely persuasively and truthfully. So he inhabited totally the character through voice. Now, it seems to me that the Abbey style that I witnessed in so many of those old actors, and then in Cyril himself, and then on and on to you and to Donalan, was where what you saw on the stage was character. You didn't see acting. And when I went across the water and saw English actors, and I saw fantastic panache and style and delivery, but I saw the acting. I saw the acting imposed on the character. I never saw that when I was watching Cyril or FJ or, you know, any of the greats. They inhabited the character completely. And that was one of the things I thought about. And then the other one that I thought about was the classlessness that you saw on the Abbey stage that you didn't see. In England, there was... you had to speak properly for a start off. You couldn't, until Look Back in Anger, the Osborne, when everything shifted and changed and regional accents were allowed on the stage in England. Before that, you had to speak like David Niven. Whereas over here, there was no embargo at all. And it allowed the Irish voice to speak in all its richness and variety. And I think that also was a very important part of the tradition.
The greatness of Yeats and Lady Gregory was that they stepped outside of the distinctions of class and religion to create a space where Irish people could find a real voice. Playwright Thomas Kilroy.
Yeah, I mean, it was a mix of two quite different sensibilities, you know. One Anglo-Irish with strong connections to England, to the Crown Civil Service, to the legal system, to the business establishment, and the other being what you just called the Native Irish, with its roots in very ancient Gaelic culture in this country. And the coming together of these in the literary and dramatic movement of Yeats was ironical, because it coincided with two things. First of all, the movement of Ireland towards revolutionary independence of England. And secondly, it coincided with the decline of the Anglo-Irish class itself. So at that very point in history, you actually had a flowering of this coming together of the two
for want of a better term, the two traditions on this island. It had certain, I think, very pronounced effects upon the kind of theatre which was produced. One of which was that because of the separation, if you wish, or the distancing of the writers from their material, these were Anglo-Irish writers writing about peasant Ireland, writing about a world that was politically, socially, and in ethos different to them, to their background. Because of that, you have a distancing effect in the writing, which, of course, is essential for all great art, but usually is provided intellectually by the writer, as it is in Joyce. In this case, it was provided by social circumstances, almost. And I think that that distancing effect is to be found, as far as we can understand it, in the acting style of the early Abbey company. The famous description of the early Abbey players' use of stillness, immobility, and this sense of a kind of quietness on the stage, which was so admired and was seen to be so revolutionary. I think that this is, in fact, the same kind of distancing that we're talking about in the writing. The other thing, of course, is that Yeats, because of Yeats, this was a theatre with an extraordinary emphasis upon text, upon literature, upon the literary quality of the drama. And because of that, the question of acting seemed to be of lesser account. The actor was just serving this literature, this great literature. And that has had an effect upon subsequent acting and subsequent development of the Abbey Theatre in Ireland.
I mean, two things. I mean, I think that when you yield to the text as an actor, that's when you become great. But because unquestionably some of those actors were regarded as great, rather they weren't regarded as merely servants of the text, were they?
Yes, McCormack and Arthur Sinclair, Barry Fitzgerald in his own kind of way, and Arthur Shields, Sally Allgood. These were actors who they were interpreting on the stage for the first time authentically Native Irish people. They were reacting in style as actors. They were reacting against, we'd say, the 19th century melodrama and the 19th century exaggeration, although it had its own influence, I think, too, on the acting style. But I think that the history of 20th century Irish theatre from the point of view of the actor has not been written yet. And it's going to be a very rich and interesting history when it is written. Because for me, as a playwright, many of the great moments in Irish theatre have been acting moments. And you could argue that you could write about the nature of Irish theatre, concentrating upon certain special moments in the theatre. Moments like Donal McCann in Faith Healer, or in The Steward of Christendom, Siobhan McKenna in Ballygan Goyra, which I saw down in the Tybark in Galway, or if I may say so, yourself in my own play, Double Cross. And these are moments that sum up something quintessentially unique to the theatre that they come out of. They are occasions where you have this conjunction of great acting with writing and a particular kind of audience participation. You know, that something happens on these occasions where the audience becomes part of the theatricality. And this, for me, is most exciting in theatre when this happens. It doesn't happen very often, but it does happen. And you could look at those occasions and say quite a lot about the nature of Irish theatre through performance, actually performance of on the stage. These are moments when actors are not just speaking to an audience. In some way, they're speaking on behalf of the audience as well. so that they're not just serving the text, they're actually incorporating it bodily in some extraordinary fashion, so that acting becomes an extension of the writing. And when this kind of thing happens, then you have sublime theatre. You also have theatre which characterises the culture, because at these moments in theatre, and you can think of them outside Ireland as well, like Olivier in The Entertainer, or Uta Hagen in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf in New York. These are occasions where there is some kind of profound tapping in to the communal consciousness. And there are moments when theatre is articulating something about the nature of the culture itself. Sometimes in a very revolutionary way, sometimes in an elegiac way, sometimes in a barbarous way, a shocking way, but it's what live theatre can accomplish like no other medium.
Maybe it's no coincidence that as a student in the 1960s I was drawn to the Abbey Theatre. Because as Terry Eagleton tells us in his book After Theory, the 1960s resembled nothing quite so much as the 19th century fin de siècle. The closing decades of the 19th century were an astonishing blend of political and cultural radicalism. It's the period of both anarchism and aestheticism, decadence and the Great Dock Strike. In Ireland, Maud Gonne and Constance Markievicz moved easily between theatre, the women's movement, prison reform, Irish republicanism, and the Parisian avant-garde. W.B. Yeats was poet, mystic, political organiser, folklorist, occultist, theatre director and cultural commissar. Something of this heady brew was inherited by the 1960s. Culture was a language which faced both ways, towards the personal and the political simultaneously. The same idiom could encompass anti-psychiatry and anti-colonialism. The crucial question for me has always been whether an actor wants to be a mimic or wants to find his own voice. The actors of the early Abbey Theatre found their voice in the theatre, in the radically new plays that were provided for them, and in their connection with their community. What was called the Abbey style was, as Yeats described it, Irish people speaking Irish words, with a rhythm that was native rather than imposed upon them. Their expression and their language faced both ways, towards the personal and the political, and that, I believe, is the strength of the tradition we call Abbey acting.
The ensemble, I think, is also related to community. Mm-hmm. That it is producing on the stage not the individual experience as such, but the communal experience, the experience of society. And I think that what was going on in the early Abbey Theatre was as revolutionary in its way as anything going on the street or at the barricades, for this reason, that it was given voice for the first time to this community, which is, in itself is a revolutionary act. You know, these were people who were essentially voiceless. They were unknown, you know, they were not present. They were absences. G- given the nature of the history, and to actually bring them into the light, as it were, or this, even if it's just stage light, is itself as revolutionary as taking up a gun and saying, get out of my country. Because what it's doing is it's empowering the people through art. And that was the great achievement of Yeats and his fellow Anglo-Irish artists, including the actors, over those early decades.
Stages. The Abbey Style was presented by Stephen Ray. The contributors were Sinead Cusack, Thomas Kilroy, Tomás McGana, Sinead McCool, T.P. McKenna and Ronnie Masterson. Music was composed by Conor Linehan and readings were by Ingrid Craigie. The production team was Clodagh Lynham, Kevin Reynolds and Sean Rocks. Sound supervision was by Richard McCulloch. Different Stages was made with the support of Sound and Vision Broadcasting Funding Scheme, a BCI initiative.